Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, from the reaction of quite a bit of the corporate media, the community organizing group, ACORN, is poised to steal the election for Barack Obama. Scattered stories that allege fraudulent voter registrations have been the subject of wall-to-wall TV coverage. What facts are missing from the outraged reporting on CNN and Fox News? Is this a ploy to divert attention from more serious attempts to suppress votes? We'll ask Lori Menitti, assistant professor of political science at Barnard College. Also on Counterspin today, how will race affect voter attitudes in the coming election? Will we see the Bradley effect, where voters tell pollsters they will support the African American but then vote otherwise on Election Day? And does some McCain campaign rhetoric carry a racially tinged subtext, as the Associated Press reported? We'll talk to Bethany Albertson, a political psychologist and professor in the political science department at the University of Washington. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
While the pundits don't always agree on certain storylines in the presidential election, there seems to be a corporate media consensus that says the current financial turmoil means that the presidential candidates need to tell the public some hard truths, namely that the government has to curtail spending. Debate moderators like Bob Schieffer and Tom Brokaw have pressed the candidates to announce their spending cuts, and the media have been almost universally disappointed with Obama and McCain's failure to do so. From the Washington Post to USA Today's editorial page, the message has been the same: the government must cut back. But does that argument make any economic sense? Economists have been pointing out, to little avail it would seem, that government spending is one of the best tools to encourage economic growth in the midst of this sort of slowdown. In fact, some have noted that the failure to do this was what made the Great Depression, well, not so great. With all the talk about avoiding another such calamity, it's strange that the media elite seem to be giving exactly the wrong advice to the candidates.
Heading into the final presidential debate, there were some indications that the McCain campaign would unveil a new economic plan, since by most indications, voters still overwhelmingly prefer Obama on such matters. The details were sketchy, but the message the campaign was sending to the media was that this would be a package of tax cuts to benefit the middle class. That message was heard and then sent loud and clear by the Washington Post, which reported on October 15th that McCain, quote, proposed $52 billion in tax breaks on Tuesday that aim to encourage savings and provide relief to seniors and the unemployed, ensuring that both presidential candidates will head into their final debate Wednesday night armed with fresh plans to ease middle-class burdens, close quote. Seniors, the unemployed, middle-class burdens. Okay, is there actually much evidence that McCain's plan would have such an impact? One proposal would cut taxes on unemployment benefits, so in that sense, the answer is yes. But a bigger part of the plan aims to cut capital gains taxes in half, which would mostly benefit wealthier Americans. McCain is also proposing a cut on investment income. All in all, the picture seems less about helping the unemployed and the middle class and more about helping relatively affluent investors. The Post falls down on this one. The New York Times, on the other hand, includes the views of an expert from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center who explained that, quote, McCain's tax proposal would help most those with pretty high incomes, the group least in need of assistance, close quote. The group found that two-thirds of the benefits of capital gains cuts would go to millionaires, reporting that relies less on spin from the campaigns and more on that kind of analysis is a step in the right direction.
When corporate media look to explain the election, they often try to isolate certain trends that they see coming from both campaigns. Thus, reporting about the negativity of the McCain campaign is balanced by comments about the negativity of the Obama campaign. But the things the media find objectionable are often downright bizarre. Many pundits were taken aback recently by the Obama campaign calling McCain erratic. Apparently, that is ageist. On NBC's Chris Matthews show, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius called it code, to the agreement of the other NBC panelists. According to host Matthews, it wasn't merely McCain's age they were going after, it was also an attack on his war injuries. On October 8th, on MSNBC's Hardball, Jim VandeHei of The Politico explained, quote, if you listen to what the Obama camp has been saying over the last couple of days, you don't really have to be a sort of political scientist to figure out what they're trying to say is that he is like a nutty old man, that McCain is erratic, he's crazy, he's too old to be president, close quote. Is that really what they're saying? The erratic line first seemed to come up in an Obama TV ad, which was quoting a USA Today editorial calling McCain's response to the financial crisis erratic. It's hard to see why one would flag this as out of bounds. McCain, you might remember, quote-unquote suspended his presidential campaign to return to Washington to oversee the bailout negotiations in Congress. McCain even suggested he'd bow out of the first presidential debate. But McCain actually did very little in those negotiations and has since floated a variety of economic proposals. Calling that erratic seems to have nothing to do with McCain's age and more to do with his actions. But the pundits have a way of hearing and seeing things very differently.
What did New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt find when he took a look at his paper's presidential campaign coverage? According to Hoyt, in an October 12th report, out of 270 news articles published in the Times about the election since the national tickets were formed in late August, only 29, or, quote, a little over 10%, were primarily about policy substance, and that is a generous tally that includes some very brief items, close quote. Hoyt pointed out that his tally was similar to the findings of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which found that 8% of front-page election articles in the Times from late August through early October addressed policy. Almost three-quarters of the stories were about the horse race, political tactics, polls, and other non-policy subjects. Sadly, the Times doesn't fare much better than network news shows, which, according to a survey of primary coverage published by Fair in May, found that issues were the dominant theme in just 5% of campaign stories. In a masterstroke of understatement, Hoyt concluded about his paper's coverage, quote, the Times numbers are about the same as for the news media in general, including cable television and blogs. Not a standard to aspire to, close quote.
And finally, speaking of standards, if you watch enough TV, you've probably seen commercials for the climate change advocacy group We Can Solve It, which is affiliated with Al Gore's Alliance for Climate Protection. One place you apparently can't see their advertisements, though, is on ABC's 2020. Their group has launched a campaign to ask ABC to allow them to buy time on the Friday night news magazine, and that petition has been signed by over 200,000 people. ABC's rationale for refusing the ad is downright strange. According to the Alliance, ABC explained that their guidelines state that, quote, national buildings may be used in advertising provided the depictions are incidental to the advertiser's promotion of the product or service. Given the messages and themes of this commercial, the image of the Capitol building is not incidental to this advertising. Please replace the image with one that is not of another national building or monument, close quote. Of course, the climate group included the Capitol building in the ad because, well, that's kind of where laws are made. It's hard not to think of another bit of context here. The co-host of ABC's 2020 is John Stossel, one of the few major media figures who remains a so-called climate skeptic. So ABC will allow an anchor to use the public airwaves to purvey misleading, unscientific opinions about climate change, but a group taking the opposite position can't buy an ad on the very same show.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
Well, if you heard the October 15th presidential debate, you heard John McCain say that the community organizing group ACORN is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy. Not exactly subtle, but then again, not exactly unlike the kinds of commentary one can hear on talk radio and cable news these days. The story of ACORN and voter registration has received enormous media coverage. Does the attention bear any relationship to this problem, though? How does registering Mickey Mouse to vote compare to, say, potentially removing thousands of eligible voters from the rolls before Election Day? Joining us to size up the real election problems is Lori Maniti. She's an assistant professor of political science at Barnard College and co-author of the forthcoming book, As Many As We Could, Keeping the Black Vote Down in America. Lori Maniti, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
I guess we almost have to start with this Acorn story. If you tune into Fox or CNN for any length of time, you no doubt see that registration forms collected by Acorn are obviously questionable. The implication that's drawn, though, is that Acorn is somehow trying to rig the election in Barack Obama's favor. Of all the potential problems with voting this year, where does this kind of registration fraud rank?
This is a very small problem that is at the bottom of the list of the kinds of problems that we could see on election day that would actually affect far more voters and votes. So this is really a kind of a distraction, and this should not be the story of this election. You know, this is really an exciting time because so many Americans want to vote, and I think that's what you're hearing is kind of these competing stories from the two parties. One is a story about new voters, and the other is the story about Acorn. And so, you know, the facts are that the problem that's being pointed to, voter registration fraud, should not be a big story in the news right now.
Is there something about this story that's kind of unseemly, the images of Acorn workers being kind of harassed by TV reporters? What kind of message is this sending, do you think?
I think this is actually a conscious attempt to not only smear Acorn, which your listeners may know is a 37-year-old organization. It's actually a kind of network of community organizations that's been in the business of trying to organize low-income people and bring them into the political process. And, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of surprising that conservatives who are launching these attacks would be against this, because the idea is that we organize in low-income communities and people bring their needs, their issues, their interests in an orderly way into the political process as voters. So that's been the business of Acorn for a very long time. And to smear them as if they are, as some Republican Party officials have called them, a quasi-criminal organization and so forth, and to try to stoke sort of racist images of the inner city and African-Americans and low-income people, I think is really a quite serious smear on this organization, not deserved at all.
The whole obsession with Acorn has the look, as you mentioned, of some kind of diversion. There are actual tactics of voter suppression that seem to go begging right now while the TV cameras are trained on Acorn workers walking into their offices. What are those stories, real quickly, across the country? Which ones do you think stand up out to you as things that are begging for media scrutiny?
Well, there appears to be a kind of strategy on the part of the Republican Party across the country to question the qualifications of all of these new voters, millions of people who've been signed up by groups like Acorn, but also just have come into the process because they've found this such a compelling election. And so we've heard stories, for example, about campaigns to put together lists of new voters who will be challenged at the polls or challenged before the election, may require them to present other kinds of identification. That's a direct kind of voter suppression tactic. But there are also ways in which the rules, the election rules for maintaining the registration system or for operating, you know, on election day, how those two can be commandeered in a way and used to prevent some Americans from voting. And the casebook study now of this is really the 2000 election, when we all saw in Florida all the kinds of problems that could conspire on election day to prevent something like 170 or 180,000 votes just in Florida. These were ballots that should have been legitimate ballots that were not counted for all kinds of problems that had to do with voter confusion, with machine breakdown, with people's names not being on lists. So these are the less nefarious kinds of system problems that is really the big problem in the electoral system today, is still that we have not solved all these problems. And so, you know, there's both the campaign strategies, which sort of fall into the category of dirty tricks, and there's the story of an electoral system that is too complex for its own good and collapsing sometimes in a way that prevents Americans from, you know, casting a ballot and having it counted. And that's really a bad thing.
And as you were mentioning earlier when we were talking, there's a certain efficiency to this. Registering fake voters is not going to have a real impact come election day. Challenging real voters is a much more efficient and straightforward strategy of trying to to swing an election one way or the other.
Yeah, it's really kind of a diabolical system because we know, or at least I know from my own research, and I've been working on this for years, to try to actually get at the bottom of the question of how much fraud is there? How easy is it to commit fraud? What safeguards are in place? And I can tell you that I found almost no cases in the last 8 years of any fraudulent registration card being converted into an illegal ballot on election day, meaning no connection whatsoever between the voter registration fraud that's being, you know, kind of shouted about in the media today and any real problem in terms of illegal ballots. So, you know, this is, as I said, it's a story that really shouldn't be a story right now. The question about how many people are prevented from voting is also a difficult one to document because it's very difficult to actually measure how many people don't show up because they've heard something on the news or they caught something on Fox or they caught something on CNN. And it made them concerned that voting was just going to be a huge hassle. There's going to be a four-hour line. They might be asked for some ID that they don't have. They don't really know where they should go. And they don't show up. But it's hard for us in some ways to point to that, although we did talk a little bit about a report that was done on the 2000 election and how social scientists tried to document just that problem. Actually, it's not the problem of vote suppression per se, but the number of lost votes. And they concluded that some 4 to 6 million votes in the 2000 election of eligible American citizens were not counted because of all kinds of problems. And so you add to that the people who just don't even show up at all and can't be counted in those categories. And we have, you know, a really major problem. It's a good explanation for the non-voting problem that we political scientists are constantly trying to scratch our heads about, you know, how to solve.
You had mentioned a role the media plays in these kinds of stories in general by reinforcing these bogus storylines, perhaps wittingly, perhaps unwittingly, by covering some of these partisan allegations about vote fraud uncritically. And as you explained it, a state party somewhere gathers the press and explains, here's this latest outrage about vote fraud. It gets reported in the local newspaper. And then what happens?
Well, it's also a very kind of ingenious strategy because first they generate the press by holding a phony kind of press conference and they get people to show up to it and they stand in front of somebody's house and they say, this person here is not actually a legally registered voter and we just want to show you this really does happen. There is a real person here who's trying to cheat the system. And they get coverage. They generate the news. They generate the news reports. And then the news reports bounce around all over the place. So they collect them all, and they put them together in a report. And then they use the report as evidence. And I've seen this. They've used these reports actually in litigation. They've used them to supplement congressional testimony as evidence that there's voter fraud. And when you just look at it, you start to scratch your head again. Because what you look at are the same kinds of stories that are just reporting allegations that are being made, in this case, by Republican officials about voter fraud, that it's there, although there's no proof that it's there. The allegation becomes the fact, and the news stories collect and are combined and, you know, kind of collated and pulled together, and you've got a nice fat report. And then the report becomes the evidence, and it's a kind of vicious cycle, and also I think a real actually conscious strategy to use the media as part of a kind of campaign tactic.
We've been speaking with Lori Menidi. She is an assistant professor of political science at Barnard College and co-author of the forthcoming book, As Many As We Could, Keeping the Black Vote Down in America, due out in January from the New Press. Lori Menidi, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Peter.
There has been much media attention to how race will affect voting patterns in the coming election. We know from their frank admissions that some white voters will not vote for Barack Obama simply based on race. Will others, in what has been described as the Bradley effect, tell pollsters they support Obama only to vote otherwise on Election Day? And is the McCain campaign exploiting underlying racist sentiment with rhetoric that, according to the Associated Press, carries a racially tinged subtext? These issues have been raised by many in the wake of McCain campaign charges that Obama pals around with terrorists, is intimately linked with ACORN, a group advocating for the inner city poor, and descriptions of Obama as otherly and different from us. Joining us to talk about race in the election is Bethany Albertson. She's a political psychologist and assistant professor in the political science department at the University of Washington in Seattle. She is also the co-author of a forthcoming study on the Bradley Effect. Welcome to Counterspin, Bethany Albertson.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us what you found in your upcoming study on the Bradley Effect.
We collected the polls that were done within a week of each state primary, and these were just the primaries, not the caucus states. And we analyzed the polls for their accuracy. How did they relate to how the candidates did? And what we found was that sometimes, as we feared going into this, sometimes Barack Obama underperformed relative to pre-election polling. But the more notable trend or the more surprising trend was that sometimes he overperformed relative to pre-election polling. So that in some states like New Hampshire and California, he seems to have underperformed. In other states, notably states in the South, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, he seems to do better than pre-election polling suggests.
Among white voters, Barack Obama actually performed better on election day than he did in the polls pre-election.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to get at because with the polls, we can break things down by demographic groups. And with the vote outcome, we're dealing with aggregates. And one trend we noted early on was that Barack Obama's overperformance and underperformance seemed to be related to the percent African-American in the state. So these more heavily populated with African-American states, the states in the South, were the states in which he was overperforming, which, you know, at first made us think, well, maybe this is an effect that's driven by African-American voters. When you move away from the vote totals into the exit polls, which is an important shift, because then you have to start thinking about inaccuracies with exit polls. But when you make that move, you could see that the trend is driven not only by African-American voters, but also by white voters.
So in some cases, the Bradley effect seemed to be in effect. In other cases, it was sort of a reverse Bradley effect. Is there any indication in those southern states where Barack Obama overperformed that perhaps white voters were embarrassed or trying to hide that they were voting for a black candidate?
That's definitely one interpretation. One difficulty with research on the Bradley effect or the reverse Bradley effect is oftentimes the mechanism's not clear. And some confusion, you know, that comes across in the reporting of these things is for some people, Bradley effect means misrepresenting one's vote intention. The voter saying, I'm going to vote for the African-American candidate, knowing full well they're not going to, or saying they're undecided, knowing they're not. Whereas for others, and the way I treat the term, it's simply the discrepancy, whether it's driven by misrepresentation, genuine indecision, or sampling issues. Just to say there could be multiple mechanisms for these discrepancies.
I'd like to get into some of the other theories that are floating around out there. While some observers have downplayed the currency of the Bradley effect, others have suggested, the Washington Post's Dana Milbank has reported on this, that the racist anti-Obama vote is baked into the polls already. That is, those reluctant to vote for Obama based on race are showing up in polls as supporters of McCain or others. The suggestion is that were it not for racism, Obama would be leading McCain even more dramatically. Now, others suggest that the racist vote may be hiding out in the undecideds. What about this notion that the racist anti-Obama vote is baked into the polls already?
That idea has been getting a lot of coverage based on the AP Yahoo poll demonstrating that Americans hold a variety of negative racial stereotypes and that this cuts across party lines. This isn't news to anybody in political psychology and probably isn't news to many Americans. But the question is how do these general stereotypes translate onto one individual? That's not clear at all. So we know, for instance, people hold negative racial stereotypes. We also know that people hold negative stereotypes as they relate to age. And yet the transition from a negative elderly stereotype to an attitude towards McCain isn't clear. So there's some guessing going on in terms of translating the AP Yahoo results to a specific, Obama should be doing this much better than he is doing in the current poll. A 2007 Gallup survey asked people, if your party nominated a person of a variety of characteristics, would you vote for that person? And one of the characteristics was a well-qualified 72-year-old. and 42% said they were unwilling to vote for that person, which would be terrible news for John McCain if that literally translated to attitudes towards McCain. 5% said they'd be unwilling to vote for a black person who was their party's nominee. And that's just to say that there's messiness in taking attitudes towards a demographic category, a racial category, an age category, or even a hypothetical presidential candidate, and then translating that on to Barack Obama or John McCain.
Well, as a political psychologist, what is your take on whether there is a racially tinged subtext in some of the campaign rhetoric we're hearing? Do you think there may be some racially coded messages in some of this McCain rhetoric that describes Obama as otherly and not like the rest of us and charges him with links to terrorists and ACORN, a group that champions inner city poor?
Sure, I definitely worry about that. I think, you know, it's less interesting to me is that the intent behind the campaign. What's more interesting to me is, will those messages resonate in a way that depends upon one's racial attitudes? And, you know, in our field, there's plenty of evidence to say that they could. What got Tony Greenwald, my co-author in the pre-election polling work, what got the two of us thinking about accuracies in pre-election polling was our work on implicit attitudes, reactions we hold, attitudes we hold beneath the level of conscious awareness. What we found in our research on implicit attitudes towards the candidates in the Democratic primary was that both Hillary Clinton and John Edwards were preferred at an implicit level based on reaction times to Barack Obama. And this was notable because our sample preferred Obama when we asked them explicitly, who do you prefer for president? And this doesn't mean they're lying. It doesn't mean they don't really prefer Barack Obama. It just might mean there's some softness in their support that perhaps based on negative racial stereotypes that they hold may not even be aware of. It could be that these attacks resonate in a way that they wouldn't if Barack Obama weren't an African-American candidate.
We've been speaking with Bethany Albertson. She is a political psychologist and professor at the University of Washington, Seattle. Bethany Albertson, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.